So, Chaka Talk, artist residency in the Amazon rainforest, Peru. Hi, I'm Trina Brammer, and with us here today is a very special guest, Erin Laurie. Erin came to visit us 10 years ago, and she was one of our first artists. We hadn't even built the art centre in the mountain at that point. We were renting studio space in the village. So I've been following Erin for many years, and just very, very excited to, I'm always very excited to find out more about her process and what goes into her work. So I'm like a little kid here. So I hope that you we'll enjoy the amazing work of Erin Laurie. So we'll start off where we should always start off is, where are you from and what is your background, and tell us a little bit about your art career there, which is a very amazing art career that you have there in Canada. So I'll let you begin.
Hi, Trina. Hey, everyone. Thanks for that great introduction, Trina. It's truly an honor to be on this podcast. Our friendship has grown in interesting ways over the years, and you always inspire me to be a better person than artist and to be a more honest person than artist. So I'm really happy that we're going to have this conversation. So I am an artist. I'm based in Toronto, Canada. And I grew up in a small town a few hours east of here. And I moved here to go to school to do my undergrad, to get my BFA in drawing and painting in 2007. So I've been here ever since. And I love it, but it's getting to be time for me to leave. So I'll reconsider that when the time comes. But I've been interested in art for as long as I can remember. I think as old as I could hold it, ever since I could hold a crayon, basically. That side of me was nurtured from my dad and my mom. My dad's a musician and an artist, and we used to draw for hours on the floor on Bristol board, and he taught me how to see the world and to translate that into my drawings. And he also was very interested in humor, and he used to draw lots of cartoons and caricatures. So I think I learned how to be a bit, well, very imaginative in that way as well. So I had some great artistic influences from my family and my aunts and uncles and cousins and everybody. But basically for my whole life, until my last year of my undergrad at OCAD, I did realistic, anatomically correct drawings. And so the thing was, back up until that point, I had made sure to plan everything. There was absolutely no room for spontaneity, for chance, for any kind of evolution in my process. And it was really stifling and it felt very limiting. So I spent a few years in extreme discomfort trying to move out of that. But I was still incorporating the figure to some degree, even though I was, trying to place the figures in some, more interesting, abstract, painterly, amorphous backgrounds or landscapes, but I hadn't quite let go of the figure yet. And so what ended up happening was a couple of days before my last year in my undergrad, which is obviously the most important year because you're supposed to make a body of work that's cohesive and based on research. And I broke my third metatarsal just a few days before that year started. So everything that I thought was going to happen just went totally out the window. And I had to learn to rely on help for literally everything. And it was super, super uncomfortable. I couldn't get my own coffee or buy my own art supplies or stretch my own canvases or anything. And so what ended up happening that year was because my bone didn't heal either. I was too stressed out and, university life. So I started painting dozens and dozens of these small self-portraits, which at first were very, I was always using references at this time as well, I should mention that. But they were very tight and they were very, I was always trying to achieve a kind of likeness of the person, of myself. And over time, as like emotions and tension had built up in me as a result of not being able to really express myself fully or move around physically, I started to loosen up a bit. And I was looking at a lot of artists that really use paint liberally and freely and were trying to capture like the essence of a person as opposed to their external appearance. So like artists like Bacon, Auerbach, Cecily Brown, George Kondo, to name a few, and then eventually like Alison Schulnick and Kim Dorland, and Harold Klunder helped me to see the possibilities of using paint sculpturally. And as soon as I got my cast off, which was 4 months later, I felt this extreme sense of liberation. And that was the moment that I stopped using references and source material altogether. I actually still have the two paintings from the last photo that I used. And so they're really special to me because they mark that shift. But after that moment, my focus became about the process of painting. And so I think, since then it started to become very apparent to me that there is, for me at least, such a value in the unknown and in uncertainty. And I never want to know what's going to happen with the paintings, so or the work of art, whatever it may be. I'm primarily an oil painter right now, and I work out of a studio here in Toronto. And the work generates more work, so I never have references around me. And each painting informs the next, and each painting reveals to me different questions and different curiosities that I'm able to then grapple with in the next painting. So they're all related and they're all connected by a thread that way. So my work ever since then has become about, not just the image, but also the surface and how the material itself can communicate meaning. And so actually one of my favorite artists, William Kentridge, he's a South African artist. He talks about the uncertainty of images and how this is so much closer to how the world really functions. You can see the world as a series of photographs and facts, or you can see it as in an eternal or constant process of unfolding or becoming. And so this relates to the way that I see the world, which goes back to my first experiences in meditation. I think it was in 2012. It was actually the summer right before I went to Sachaca. And so I had never meditated. And I went to this 10-day silent meditation retreat. Vipassana means to see things as they really are, and it's a way of self-transformation through self-observation. So it's really an inner journey. So you're not allowed to talk to anybody, to look at anybody, to do exercises, to write in your journal. For the entire 10 days, and you meditate for about 10 hours a day. So I totally dove into the deep end with that one. And what it showed me was that everything within me, in my body and in my mind, is in a constant state of flux. So every sensation, you train yourself to become aware of every sensation as it arises and passes in your body, and every thought that arises and passes in your mind, and how the sensations and the thoughts and the emotions are interconnected. And so one leads to another inevitably through this constant like chain reaction. And basically what you begin to understand is that there is experientially within your own body and mind that everything is impermanent. And so because you see this within yourself, it's you can't help but recognize that that's how the universe functions. And even though we can't see it, our senses are limited in that way. Just like we can't see like the full spectrum of color, everything is vibrating, everything is moving, everything is changing, and there are no separate processes. Everything is connected to everything else, and it's this beautiful, seamless, transition of matter, of energy. And so I really want my work currently to reflect this view of reality, and I think that it inevitably does. And how I achieve that is by working with oil paint wet into wet, and I'm constantly adding paint, removing paint. And so there's this on the surface of the panel or the canvas itself, this recycling and renewing of of the paint, of material, of energy, of form, of meaning. And so I love that the meaning is also in a constant state of change. And it's revealed to me as I move through the process and afterwards in reflection. And sometimes the meaning of the work doesn't even reveal itself to me until years later. And I love that actually about the process, because if I knew what was going to happen or what it was going to mean, then there's really no reason to do it, in my personal opinion. And I think that my experience at Sachaca and in the rainforest also helped inform this view of the world for me. It was the first time that I had ever been surrounded by nature for so long that I really got a chance to witness the cycles of life and death, birth, decay, growth, renewal, all of these different, processes in the natural world. And I saw those as reflected in my mind. So there was this sort of interesting synchronistic events happening externally and internally, which I think I carry that this sort of awareness into my practice as well.
So it's really hard to know where to start here. You have done an enormous amount of work, Erin. It's just amazing how hard you have worked. But I have stumbled across 2012 series, and it's. That all of those pieces, each one, are just so powerful. And so, could you go through the different work from that time, and tell us more so about what was going on in your life through each painting, so that we can live your experience through those paintings, because it seems like it was quite a transformative time.
Yeah, so the 2012, on my website even, that's the very first year that I've uploaded artwork. And to me, it feels like it was the beginning of this long, eternal, transformational journey that I have been on and continue to embark on day after day. Like I said, 2012 was the beginning of my a new chapter creatively, personally, where I began to embrace the process as opposed to the outcome of something, and so surrendering to the unknown. And so the pieces in the 2012 series, I called that series Inner Strangers, and to me, what it was really about was it was a personal journey of finding a way through painting of externalizing different fragments and undigested, unresolved aspects of my own experience, and translating them into paintings, and often strange and humorous and whimsical characters. But to me, at this time, I was really going through some serious darkness within me, and I think that a lot of experiences that I had managed to compartmentalize and avoid for basically, my entire life were beginning to surface. So this was an extremely uncomfortable, which is often a part of the transformative process, of course, the beginning of it, extremely uncomfortable. But the paintings, they healed me. And so I use a lot of really bright, vivid colors to communicate something that I felt was a bit darker in subject matter. And all of the paintings from 2012, most of them are either vertical format, which mirrors the body. So you can see this sort of from head to foot, the sort of flow of brush strokes and energy and movement going from top to bottom to back again. And then there are a bunch of these different, like I said, smaller self-portraits that are often just showing like the bust or the head in some very loose and abstract interpretive way. And so I think at this point, especially with the portraits, the straight up portraits of heads, you can see that, the head is situated on a very hazy, luminous gradation of colors in the background, a soft, diffused background. And the head itself, the shape of the head, is full of thick, interwoven strokes of paint. It's very messy, it's very chaotic. And what I think was happening at this time was that I was very caught up and I was entangled in my own thought processes, and I wasn't as connected to the body. I was in my head and I was trying to get out. And you can see, so there's a lot of, in the portraits, there's a lot of like spill out of paint, of color, of material. So that's kind of what I think happened there. Like there's a painting called Sooner or Later, which it depicts a sort of darker, foreboding figure with a just a dark face set against this bright orange background. And you can see spilling out of this character's heart all of this like black, sludgy liquid. And so the title Sooner or Later, it speaks to the emotions and experiences that we suppress or that become repressed, the inevitability of that, of the outpouring of that, of the coming out of that, and in often unpredictable, untimely ways. So yeah, this entire series was extremely meaningful to me. Let's see what else we have. That painting Dissolution was inspired by my experiences in meditation, where you feel this sort of rushing of energy through the body, and you literally feel the physical body dissolve. And so this series was really all about the letting go of an identity, grappling with the grief and the separation that's felt in that sense. So, even before this series, I was doing a lot of drawings where and paintings where you'd actually see heads or bodies ripping apart from one another. And it looks quite painful, and it is psychologically painful. So this was the beginning of my honestly, my spiritual journey and my journey to self-awareness and self-knowledge. So these paintings are very, very, very special. There's also a piece in this series called Purge, and it's a like dragon-like character in the center of the painting. It's 5 by 4 feet, and you see these strokes coming out of the mouth, and then there's this sort of I used to drag a dry brush through the painting, spiraling out and around the central form, so it looks very very like you're unsettled and you're wheezy and it's like you're unable to see clearly, and there's this disorientation about this image. And you see that brush and that spiraling of strokes happening a lot in my earlier works. There's also I'm reading this book right now, and it, like I said, the meaning of the work often emerges years later, and like 10 or 11 years later, I'm seeing this. Or wait, 8 years later, 9 years later. Anyways, I'm coming to new understandings about this work. And so I'm reading this book right now called No Boundary by Ken Wilber. And so he talks about how we are multidimensional beings and that we are operating on and inhabiting different aspects and levels of consciousness at all times. And so, for example, if you're asked the question, who are you? How do you respond to that? And the way that you respond depends on the state of consciousness that you are inhabiting in that moment. So he talks a lot about the rainbow spectrum of consciousness, which is clearly relating to the chakras, the lower to the upper chakras. And basically, how you would answer that question, who are you, depends on where you draw the self, not self boundary line. So a really common boundary line for the self, not self, is the the outer boundary of the organism, so the skin. So whatever is outside of the organism is considered not you. It's considered foreign. It's considered other. And then within the body, you could draw the boundary line between the body and the mind, so that you are your mind, but you're not your body. And you see people with often like illnesses and diseases relating to themselves this way because they feel like the disease is something foreign, it's attacking them. So there's this divide within their body in that sense. And then even within their minds, within their own psyches, they can draw the boundary line between different aspects of the self that you accept and don't accept, or that you reject and that you don't reject. So there's this compartmentalization within the self, and it just depends on where you draw the line. That line is also very fluid and flexible, and it's constantly being redrawn, again, based on the state of consciousness that you're embodying in that moment. And then there's the experience of unity consciousness, which is often that's off. I mean, that can be triggered in multiple different, many different ways, like through meditation or through taking psychedelics or creating an artwork or in intimate relationships. But that's basically where you see yourself as one with the entire universe. And in that situation, the boundary line actually dissolves. So, what I realized about the series called Inner Strangers, and Ken Wilber actually used that phrase, inner strangers, to describe the parts of yourself that you are not willing to or able to confront or look at. And he talks about, too, which I find so fascinating, this idea that wherever you draw a boundary line is also a potential battle line. So whenever you have something and it's other, or something that's foreign, there's a possibility of conflict, a possibility of battle. And so there is a possibility of disease, dis-ease, or disharmony. So anyways, I just found that like it just added a whole new layer of meaning to that series for me. So because my work is never planned, what's most important to the artwork itself is that I live as interesting and full a life as possible. Because it's inevitable that everything that I experience, I see, that I smell through my senses, and I feel, all of this gets filtered through my unique lenses and then comes through the work organically. And so I love that painting is such an opportunity for us to confront and become aware of our own tendencies and habits and our unconscious mind, and not just that, but like the universal consciousness. I think so much comes through in the painting process if you allow it. And that's where the real magic happens. I've tried to plan certain things, and I've tried to create series, and I've introduced some constraints at different points in my practice. But the truth is, the best work always comes from a place of total allowance, total surrender. And that doesn't mean that it's easy. Of course, there are many, many, many times when I struggle for days and months with a painting. But at the same time as there is that struggle, there is this overarching sense of allowing and conversing with the painting, allowing it to tell me what it needs. And so there's this, actually, Ellen, one of the other artists at Sachaka, she has a podcast you can listen to. She talked to me one time about, she told me the story about the inner life of the painting. And ever since she told me that story, it's just solidified this idea in my mind that each painting has its own sort of like spirit. It's a really mystical thing. And I think that each painting is its own universe, it's its own entity. And although it is just one piece of the greater whole, of the greater puzzle, they are their own contained universe, and they speak to me in very different ways. And so I'm always learning from my process, and that's, as soon as I stop learning from the paintings, that's when it's time to move on or time to change something. But I think that, yeah, it's all about openness and receptivity.
Your larger work are always so impressive. I mean, it's so much different working large than it is from a small painting. And I know that there's some quite lots of technical difficulties that you have with working large. But what I'd like to speak about as well as how you achieve a painting which is 48 by 96 inches, and you have which is 244 centimeters, because I work in centimeters, and then you have one here that's it's 180 inches long, which is quite a large painting. So first of all, I'd like to talk about that, like how you managed to paint such great work and then get it to the gallery, because I know that you even have issues getting it inside the gallery because it's so big. And can you also share with us your preparation drawings that is connected? So we'll start off with the looking glass. And we'll should we dissect this painting, the looking glass? And can we talk about also you were sharing that you actually write as you're painting, and I wondered if you had any written work in your sketchbook that you can help us to understand a little bit about your process.
So, yeah, the process of making a small painting, as you know, is so much different than making a large one. And I am the type of painter that likes to switch things up quite often. So I'll, move from making like an 8 by 10 inch painting to an 8 by 10 foot painting, one after the other. Because the reason is because I prefer not to get too comfortable with any process or method of making my work. And I really, really acknowledge the importance of being a beginner. And there's different ways that I can kind of get to that place. And switching up the scales from small to large to medium to back again is one of the ways that I keep my practice feeling fresh. But yeah, I mean, with the larger paintings, they're my favorite ones. They're my favorite ones to look at, and they're my favorite ones to make, because it's such an immersive experience, and it has to do with the entire body. The smaller paintings, you can just move your arm around. You can the range of motion isn't really important. It can have a lot to do with just like the flick of a wrist, really. Like the gesture that inhabits a small painting takes up so much more space. And so but I am always trying to, even when I move from a small to a large, to have the painting appear to have come into being all at once. And obviously, on a larger scale, I have to work in the way that I approach larger paintings, I work in sections. So, for example, I'll typically work on start the painting on the far right-hand side and then begin to move inwards towards the left, and then I'll just suddenly jump over to the far left. And then what I'm left with is this space in between, and then I have to figure out how to connect these seemingly disconnected sections. And I love trying to create what appears to be like a linear narrative in the work, but it's actually made up in fragments and in parts and non-linearly. And so the way that I achieve this sort of the feeling that everything was made at one time is that I work wet into wet in each section, so that I am sort of creating this sort of like loose where you see forms. You can't really tell where one form ends and one begins, and that's just because of the way that I've applied paint. And so yeah, I have to scale my tools up. I have to use like I work with a lot of screen printing squeegees, all different types and styles and sizes of brushes, and I'll sometimes attach brushes together to make a larger brush, or I'll make my own squeegees out of rubber and old broom handles. Sometimes I have to build tables to stand on. For a painting that I did recently for my most recent show, it was the largest piece that I had ever done, and It was made up in two panels because I just couldn't fit it out of the door, so it had to come in two sections. But it was one image. But that painting was 9 feet tall by 15 feet long, and I had to set up scaffolding. So the process of making that painting was very different than making, say, like a 4 by 8, like a 48 by 96 inch, like you were just talking about, Trina. I'm super comfortable on a 48 by 96 because everything is in my range of motion. Like I might have to step to the side a little bit more to reach one side of the painting and then to go to the next, but everything is within standing reaching distance pretty much. But for a large one that, like I was just talking about, you have to, it's very stop and go, and it's very physically taxing and demanding. And like, for example, I'll have to stand down. There's a lot of looking and contemplation between the actions, which I also find interesting that you just don't really get when you're looking at a completed painting, like how much time there is between some of the brush strokes. So I'll sit there and look at the painting until I sort of figure out what the next move is, and then I'll have to get up on the scaffolding, make a few marks, then get back down, then get back on, then get back down, then get back on, then get back down. And it's very, very different than making a, like, what I consider a medium to large, which is that 48 by 96 range. But yeah, the experience of making a large one to me is just so, it's so much more challenging, but it's so much more rewarding. And I love it because, on a large surface, you can really see that there are many little paintings within one painting. So I like to consider each section as the possibility of being its own little painting. And like literally painting something literally large and literally small on the same surface is really, really exciting about working on a large panel. So yeah, so to I pack up all my own paintings. I build all of my own. I build wooden corners that have spacers on the edge, because a lot of the paint that I use sort of wraps around the edges of the panels. So and because oil takes forever to dry, I don't want to squish it. So I have to build these wooden corners. So I'm basically building frames around every single painting. And that's what I do with the large paintings as well. And then I'll often put like a cage of strips of wood on the front, and then I'll put cardboard over it. So I'm making like its own little box, where nothing can touch the front of it. So it's very, the packing process is very extensive. It's very time consuming, and but it's just a part of, I just have to accept it because that's just the only way to transport the paintings that I make that are pretty much like sculptures. Yeah, and also like the idea of working large too, there's always that consideration of materials. And because I use paint so liberally, I really have to be okay with putting everything into my work. Like I literally put everything into it. All my money, all my energy, all my love, all my care, all my attention. And so I'm never really feeling like it's a waste or a risk because it needs that. Like for me personally, without that material, that those globs and that, like the possibility of working with a paint sculpturally, I just feel like it lacks some kind of physical presence. And what I want in a painting is for it to feel like there's like a presence of a person or a spirit in the room with you. So yeah, you mentioned Looking Glass. It's funny that you mentioned that painting. I love that painting. It was actually a commission, interestingly enough. And but the way that I do commissions typically is I'll take some direction in terms of maybe if they wanted to give me direction or input in terms of the color palette or maybe the amount of texture or something kind of open like that. But I always tell the client that I don't know what's going to happen, and they have to be okay with that. Because for commissions, I want to be able to make a piece that I would just naturally make on my own anyways. I guess, the main restriction I would have would just be the size of the size and shape of the panel that is going to obviously fit in there, the desired location. But yeah, I don't like I think I might have mentioned that I don't oh no, I don't think I mentioned it. Well, I don't use references or source material, so it's all just coming out of my head, my own experience, and the work is inspired by previous work that I've done. So there's no preparatory sketch that goes into my work typically. Once in a while I'll do a sketch if I really want to get something right and it is very specific, but that's very rare. So for Looking Glass, the only element that I knew that I wanted to have in the painting was on the left you can see this like bright white diffused. You could see it as either a moon or you could see it as like a frame. You could see the white as like negative space, or a moon. And so I knew that I wanted to have that contrast of light and dark in that one area. And I felt like that would sort of set the stage for the rest of the painting. So that's what I started with. And I approach different areas of the painting very differently. So that section was just like alla prima, paint on, that's it. But then right below the white moon, you can see that I've done like a more rainbow, multicolored underpainting. And then I've layered lots of paint over top of that. And then I've taken a squeegee and removed the section and cut out paint. And then so you see that the rainbow underpainting has been stained by the paint that was on top of it. And so there's this like very beautiful, fluid, multicolored section. And then there's a hand on the right-hand side that the hand is created by a lot of oil paint that's been diluted with some solvents. And so it's very washy, it's very thin, and the white of the panel is glowing through that wash. And so the reason why I painted a hand there was that. So, oh yeah, so again, going back to the moon, that moon has been incorporated in many different paintings of mine in many different ways, in many different colors, but it is a recurring motif. And so that's where that area came from. And then the hand, previous to doing this painting, I had painted a very large landscape format painting called Fantasia and accidentally painted a hand that appeared to be picking up a ball. And the hand was this giant hand that was coming down from the top of the panel, occupying a large section of the painting. So it actually looked like the hand of God or like some larger than life being playing with this ball. So I wanted to, the hand in this painting was done a lot more consciously, but it was inspired by what had happened just by chance in the previous painting. And then, yeah, so then I'll treat some different sections, like the bottom right-hand corner of Looking Glass. It looks almost like another otherworldly little landscape with like a planet floating in the air. And then there's to the above that in the upper right-hand section, you can see what might be considered like a pyramid or a triangle shape of some sort, and the sky and some clouds. And then it looks like the hand is trying to grab some kind of interesting, maybe otherworldly, extraterrestrial, like spaceship or a pool or some kind of vessel. And then you see what appears now to me as a dragon head, a water dragon head coming through the hole of that vessel, maybe speaking something to speaking. It appears to be like communicating over to the left. So there's this I want all of the elements of every section of the painting to be speaking to each other. But the way that I like to paint is that there are all these different, again, seemingly disconnected sections, but they do relate to each other and they connect either through association or color or through literally moving from one paint from one section to another to create the other section. And so I want it to feel very playful. And so that's kind of how this painting evolved. And yeah, so it's all very organic. It's all very improvised. And like I said, I really want the painting to surprise me. And this one definitely did.
Also, can you talk a little bit about Tangled Garden as well? And also, I'd like to show the process through your sketchbook and any writing you have about that painting also. It seems a very positive painting, and yes, yeah, it's very innocent, that painting. I see it as is very light and innocent. So yeah, if you could just talk a little bit about the Tangled Garden, please, which is very large as well. How big is it?
So the Tangled Garden was the first painting that I'd ever made in response to another painting. This painting was inspired by J.E.H. McDonald's piece, The Tangled Garden. McDonald was one of the key figures in establishing the Group of Seven in the early part of the 20th century. And his painting, The Tangled Garden, is so. It's hard to explain the feeling that this painting evokes in me, but it's like this giant mass of what appeared to be like tangled plants and flowers, and they don't look pretty or beautiful like you would typically expect to see flowers or a garden painted at that time. And there's this the dom like the predominant plant in the painting is this sort of like big drooping sunflower that to me he feels like I feel like it's like a character and it's sort of like weighed down and it's feeling the weight of something. But I so this painting feels both playful and light, but also dark and unruly to me, which I think is those are really the two sides of nature that I hope to express when I'm working with, the subject of the landscape or plant life. And so my painting, The Tangled Garden, is an inspiration. It's kind of like a, I would say that I'm leaning more towards the light and playful. Like you said, it's innocent, it's kind of childlike. There are a lot of pastel, bright, playful colors. But it's not as dense. Like the visually, there's a lot of space between the different forms. And I think that what I was trying to do in this painting, and also in my life, was have was return to a sense of childlike wonder and innocence. So, like as a child, we had the woods near my house that I used to walk through every single day, and I would always find new and unworn pathways to take. So I was always in search of adventure. I was always closely observing every single blade of grass, tree, bug, bird. I was always on the lookout for salamanders. And so there was always this immediacy of the moment and allowing them and really deciding to see the magic in the everyday in nature. And this painting to me was sort of reactivating that quality in myself. And although like you do see like the central in the very middle of this painting is some kind of dark burgundy, purple, violet, these masses of strokes of paint overlaid on top of what I've talked about as the rainbow underpainting. So the rainbow again represents the inner life, the eternal unchanging nature of something, the magic behind the veils. And so you see this sort of like multidimensional creature in the center. And then to the far right, you see a lot of these different types of flowers and plants. And it's starting to appear a little bit dense in the far left-hand corner. So, and a lot of the strokes in this painting are really trying to mimic the types of very free, loose scribbles of a marker or a crayon. And I think that you can get a sense of that. There's a lot of very organic shapes and strokes and spirals and yeah, so there are a lot of primary colors in this painting, a lot of secondary colors, but it's very, it feels like it's speaking to children, or at least like the childlike aspect in someone, in the person who's looking at this painting. I started a writing practice to complement my art practice about a year ago, and it's proven to be the missing ingredient in my process. And so I wanted to have a deeper connection to each individual painting. So I started writing about each individual painting, mostly just intuitive stream of consciousness from first person. And I think that I've had in the past a huge block in terms of writing about my work, because I always tried to write, in third person, academically, in this like very structured way. And at some point I realized that that technique of writing and that way of describing the work didn't reflect the way that I actually make my paintings. And so I've just given that up, and I've embraced my own unique language and tone and the way that I well, basically, what's been happening is that I've been discovering as much in the writing process about the works as I did while making them. So I now see the writing as not just complementary to the work, but I see it as an extension of the work. And there's so much more that can be discovered and revealed through language. It is literally a different language than painting. So that's where I'm at right now, and I think that each painting like has something to say, and I'm trying to open up the channels to allow it to speak through me in a way. So I'll just read you a piece of writing that I wrote about a painting called Follow Closely. So this piece was made with the idea of the magic hour in mind. Landscape, inscape, interior, expressions of that rich interior life. Black silhouettes sit in front of the hot, fiery setting sun. These black shapes are mysterious, shape-shifting, morphing into different forms. They're playful and moving together, dancing together, swaying together. You get a sense that the whole scene is breathing as one organism. Inhale, exhale, a continuous exhale. They are playful and primal, calling out to you, to me, summoning me to come closer to merge with the darkness. The darkness that feels at once so consuming is just one side of the coin, one point of perception. The dark masses you see are simultaneously illuminated by the bright light of the sun on the flip side. Silhouettes have a backside or a front side. Why have I never considered this before? We see only the blackness of the shadows, the light screaming out from behind the shapes and creeping in from their edges. And somehow I've always only thought about this one side. It is one way of looking at things. The darker the darks, the lighter the lights. The darker things appear from this perspective, the brighter the brights on the other side. You can only know the intensity of the light from the depth of the dark. You have to use your imagination. You have to know it's there. Duality, yin, yang, always shifting, always transforming into the other. Each containing the seed of its other, of its backside. Ropes of rainbow light find their way through the foliage. They are vines and creatures of the night. They are rainbow snakes slithering through the darkness, guardians of the jungle. They protect and worship the sun, the blue sun. It's so hot, that blue, blue sun. How these silhouettes stir the imagination so profoundly and effortlessly. Ironically, it's only when we see things clearly that we begin to imagine something other than what we know. I think we're always hoping for something magical to appear and to take us away, to save us. The thing is, the magic is always there. It always has been. It always will be. You just have to switch the lens, tapping back into that childlike, innocent view of the world. Paintings invite us to return to this state, and that's why I'm always returning to the studio. It's the most powerful way that I find this connection. And so that little bit of writing was just, I was allowing the paintings to, that particular painting to suggest its meaning to me. But I've also experimented with writing as if I am the painting speaking. So it's in that way, you can sort of tap into other, something other than what we might logically see or find in the painting. It's this other way of communicating as if you are that painting. What does it have to share? How does it feel? What is it trying to communicate? What does it need? I like to play these games with writing, and I'm excited because this is just the beginning of this beautiful, rich practice. Something I also want to mention is that I want the viewer to have the same experience looking at the painting as I do when I look at it, and also when I make it, which is that ambiguity of the image is crucial. I want the painting to feel as if, or I want you to feel as if you're encountering a different work of art, a different painting every time that you step up to it. I want it to shift as you shift, because obviously we're always just bringing our own unique psychological disposition to the conversation. And, you know, again, like speaking to that book that Ken Wilber wrote, depending on the state of consciousness that you are embodying and being and expressing from in that moment, you will perceive everything outside of you differently. So, I mean, all paintings, all artwork, everything in the world and the universe is always changing depending on your perception of it. But I really do want the viewer and me to have the same experience. And I think that's important to note.
To learn more about Erin's process and also learn about the world of plant medicine in Peru, please subscribe and like our YouTube channel. And we will see you again soon.